Okay, thank you, everybody. I'm Paul Sherlock, and on behalf of the Saving It Board, it's my great pleasure to welcome you all here to the Royal Institution for the James Tizard Memorial Lecture, Many Internets, Many Lives. I'd like to begin by acknowledging and formally welcoming the Director of Intel's Interaction and Experience Research Group and former Thinker-in-Residence, Dr. Genevieve Bell, Director of MIT's Centre for Civic Media, Ethan Zuckerman, Member for Taylor and Parliamentary Secretary to the Premier, Lisa Vlahos MP, Deputy Chief Executive Officer of Defice, Dr. Craig Fowler, Chief Executive Officer of Sabenet, Ralph Leonard, my fellow directors of at Sabenet, Carolyn Anderson, Professor Richard Constantine, Virginia Deegan and Bruce Lynn, Commissioner for Aboriginal Engagement, Katia Thomas, Executive Director of eResearch SA, Mary Hobson, supporters and participants of Sabenet. I'd like to acknowledge that this event is taking place on Kaurna land, and on behalf of all present here, pay our respects to the traditional owners of this land and to their living culture. We're so lucky tonight to have two very special guests in Dr. Genevieve Bell and Ethan Zuckerman to deliver tonight's lecture. As Director of MIT's Centre for Civic Media, Ethan is a renowned American scholar, blogger and internet activist. He likes to think deeply about who gets to speak online and what the barriers to being heard are. Ethan's on his first trip to Australia, and so welcome to Australia, Ethan. Genevieve is well known to us, of course, from the Thinkers in Residence program. She's an American-based cultural anthropologist who is interested in the ways in which online and digital practices are being developed and shaped by cultural concerns, historical forces and regulatory frameworks. Live and unplugged, Ethan and Genevieve are going to explore the ways in which people are engaging in the digital world. The conversation is going to be intriguing and thought-provoking and engaging, and that's just the way James would have liked it. I know you're in for a real treat. As you all know, tonight's event is in memory of James. James was the inaugural CEO of Sabenet, the high-speed fibre broadband network that connects at very high speed our teaching hospitals, our universities, our TAFEs, our research precincts and a growing number of our private and public schools. As chair of the board of Sabenet, I had the great pleasure to work closely with James. He was a great friend and colleague and someone who I learnt a lot from. In the last few weeks of his life, James and I spoke about what he had achieved in his professional life. He was very proud of what he'd achieved as CEO of Sabenet. It was his drive and energy that saw the entire network constructed in under 12 months, and it was his vision that established the unique private-public partnership with AMCOM, which resulted in South Australian researchers having access to the most cost-effective fibre network in the world. James was also very proud of the work he'd done on the national stage as Project Director of the National Research Network and before that as Executive Director of eResearch SA. James was a rare breed. He was a strategic thinker but also an achiever, and his affable manner allowed him to cut through difficult situations, and he will always be remembered by those who knew him as someone who made good things happen. We were, in the days before he died, able to discuss with James the idea of a memorial lecture. He was delighted to think that we would want to recognise him in this way, and I'm sure wherever he is now, he's looking down on us with a smile on his face. The Sabenet board have elected to remember James in another way. We've recently had a memorial plaque installed on the lid of a Sabenet pit on Kintore Avenue, just near the War Memorial. And we're not alone in celebrating James's professional life. Early next month, the new high-performance computer for South Australian researchers will be launched by Minister Kenyon, and it will be known in James's honour simply as the Tizard machine. I think he would have liked that as well. And the federal government, through the Department of Industry, Innovation, Science, Research and Tertiary Education, earlier this year established the Tizard Prize. The prize is worth $5,000 and it will be awarded to a researcher who can demonstrate how they are using e-research tools and techniques innovatively in their research. And the prize, which will allow a researcher to attend an overseas conference of their choice, will be awarded at e-research Australasia conference in Sydney in November. We are honoured tonight to have James's wife Susan and children Leo and Cecilia and other Tysart family members, including James's mother and sister and sister-in-law with us and others. So nice to have you here, and I hope by attending tonight you'll get an even fuller appreciation of what James achieved as CEO of Sabrenet and the inspiration he was to so many people who worked with him, many of whom are in the room tonight. I'm pleased to announce tonight that James's legacy as CEO of Sabrenet is in the capable hands of Ralph Leonard, another alumnus of the government's information economy portfolio. Ralph would be the first to admit he's got big shoes to fill, but I know that James would be happy to see Ralph in the driving seat, someone who shares his vision and passion for technology and research and education, and his determination to put its importance in the forefront of our policymakers' minds. Ralph has come up to speed really quickly, and the Sabrenet board is now looking to build on what James had achieved by further extending the benefits of Sabrenet connectivity into the schools sector and by introducing Sabrenet into regional South Australia. I would also at this point like, on behalf of the board, to acknowledge and thank Peter Nissen, who stepped in as interim CEO of Sabrenet after James passed away last year. Besides James, there are two other secret ingredients that underpin the success of Sabrenet. The first is our mutually beneficial relationship with AMCOM, and the second is the highly collaborative approach of the three universities, DSTO and the state government, in the building and running of Sabrenet, and I'd like to talk briefly about those two. In late 2005, we selected AMCOM as our preferred long-term partner for building and maintaining Sabrenet. AMCOM is an award-winning ASX-listed IT and telecommunications company employing over 360 talented people across Australia. Through the delivery of innovative, flexible and cost-effective solutions and great customer service, AMCOM are the provider of choice for the converging ICT needs of business and government across Australia. And I'm pleased to recognise AMCOM as a proud sponsor of tonight's event. Unfortunately, AMCOM's CEO, Clive Stein, who knew James well, was unable to be here tonight, but in his absence he wanted me to convey a few words about AMCOM's relationship with Sabrenet and with James. He said, "The team at AMCOM was lucky enough to have the opportunity to work closely with James over a number of years. James inspired many of us with his passion and dedication to deliver an outcome to the research and education community. The Sabrenet partnership with AMCOM is a great example of how different organisations can come together with a common goal and deliver an outcome together that benefits so many. Today, Sabrenet is a platform that will enable the delivery of ICT into South Australia's future, and AMCOM are immensely proud to have contributed to this platform, and they are looking forward to continuing their partnership with us into the future. The other secret ingredient which underpins the success of Sabrenet has been the collaboration between Flinders University, the University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia, Defence Science and Technology Organisation and the State Government. By working together as one, we have established a broadband environment that enables South Australian researchers and educators to pursue world-class education and research excellence. No longer is bandwidth and communication capacity a barrier to our researchers collaborating with the very best wherever they are. And the South Australian Government is, in my view, to be congratulated for taking a long-term strategic view in working with the higher education and research community on the establishment of Sabrenet. I'd now like to welcome Mrs. Lisa Vlahos, Member for Taylor and the Parliamentary Secretary to the Premier, representing the Honourable Tom Kenyon, to say a few words.
Good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. I'd especially like to acknowledge and welcome Susan, Leo, Cecilia, Angela, Claire, Tysart and family members for coming. I hope you enjoy this evening, a very special event, no doubt to you, but also the friends and family of James. Friends and former colleagues of James, welcome too, and ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be here at the Science Exchange this evening for this inaugural James Tysart Memorial Lecture. The Premier and Minister Kenyon both extend their apologies in not being able to be here this evening. The Premier, as a Premier, a previous holder of the Science and Information Economy Technology Ministerial Portfolio, knew of James's work with Sabrenet and the illness that took his life so soon. It's clear from the attendance here tonight, and we've almost got a full house, that James's effect had James's teaching and passion for his work had a profound effect on so many people and their walks of life. James's legacy was built by talent and vision, and it was built on an understanding that technology is a great equaliser, the shaper of our future and a key to a better world. Tonight's lecture is entitled Many Internets and Many Lives. It draws upon James's passion for technology. It reflects his typically modest and self-depreciation that he was just a broadband builder. I also note that James's passion was music, and it's commemorated here tonight with the form of a little 3D printout that you've received, which is the base memento for you to remember this evening. I understand he was an enthusiastic member of a number of bands involved many of his government colleagues, and he called one of these bands key stakeholders, which is quite ironic and inappropriate considering he had a dry sense of humour, I'm told. James joined SaberNet after a successful career in the information economy portfolio in the state government. And look what he helped build. It's remarkable. Around 70 sites in all, including schools, TAFEs, university campuses, hospitals and research projects and precincts. The network comprises some 120 kilometres of fibre. And the network offers speeds of 10 gigabytes per second, 100 times faster than the speed of the NBN, or National Broadband Network, which is around 100 megabytes per second. 2012 marks the 10-year anniversary since the universities, the government, sat down together to develop a vision for this high-speed research and education network, a period which has just flown by. And yet, it's an entire eternity in technological sense, and I'm sure we'll learn about that more when we hear your speech later. James was there at the very first meeting. SaberNet is the product of a strategic vision of its proponents, the state and the Commonwealth governments and our three local universities and the Defence Science Technology Organisation in my own electorate of Taylor. Their investment and their faith in the project, coupled with the technological know-how of Amcom Telecommunications, which I pause to recognise as a key sponsor of tonight's event, has given our state a powerful tool for government, education, research and technology sectors to grow and thrive and look to our futures. It's a tool that gives our universities the chance to compete on an even terms in a global research environment and for our schools and TAFE to be innovative in the way they deliver both education and training for our future. SaberNet is the envy of other states. It is lean, it's efficient, it's competitive and it's a highly flexible model in the best practice of collaboration. And of course, driving this was James, rattling cages and never giving up. James with his expertise, his advocacy and his innovation. SaberNet is the house that James built. And finally, I'm keen to hear the views of our guest speakers, Ethan and Genevieve, both acknowledged world leaders in shaping opinions in our digital future, in future which SaberNet plays a very key role. Thank you both for coming from the United States this evening to be with us for this special night, held in honour of your friend, James Tizard. Thank you, and I look forward to hearing you.
All right. It is an incredible privilege for both Ethan and I to be here. It's an incredible privilege because I get to introduce Ethan to my country, which I love. He gets to see Adelaide, and that's really it, which in a parochial way is a good thing. And it's also an incredible privilege to be here to get to remember James and his work. We wanted to do a couple of things this evening here. As Ethan and I thought about how we wanted to reflect on James's legacy, we realised that what we wanted to do was talk about the past, the present and the future of computing and talk about what it meant to build broadband and what the consequences of that were. And we want to do that in three pieces. I sometimes think it's easier that way. So I'm going to talk for a while, then you'll get bored, then Ethan will come and talk and that will be better. And then Ethan and I will sit here and have a fierce and furious dialogue that I think would probably be the best way I can possibly imagine to remember James. So in the vernacular of my people, Ethan, we're going to have a stoush. But I haven't told you what that is yet.
You'll translate.
No, it will become self-evident. All right, so this is me. You heard many things about me. You should know that this event is being live tweeted. So this is the small plug for Twitter, which I know James is still on. Which is quite wonderful. So as I was thinking about this, I realised that, in fact, in Googling James most recently, that he is, in fact, still on Twitter, where his self-description is as broadband builder. And I loved that phrase, a man who built broadband, because there's something kind of remarkable in thinking about the work that it takes to make technology. When I was the thinker in residence in South Australia, my job was to really help the South Australian government think about technology from a human point of view, to think about what it was going to mean to connect up all the residents of South Australia to each other and to the broader world. And that was not just a project of going and talking to South Australians, but a project of an imagination, of what did it mean to imagine ourselves in a different kind of way. And I was incredibly lucky in that project to have a great many stakeholders, some of whom are in the room, and one of whom was James, who was interested in this project and who was an incredibly powerful co-interlocutor for me, but also meant that as I was thinking about broadband and what it meant, as I embarked on the journey of the thinker, many of you will remember, I spent most of my time outside of Adelaide. This photo of me is taken under a car on the Borefield Road going from Andamooka to Maree when the inevitable thing happened and we blew a tyre and shattered a rim. I have this here also to remind myself that the project of connecting a country isn't just a project of the small pieces of technology, it's of the larger adventures we all embark upon. And my time as the thinker was really about the adventure of embarking upon what would it mean to connect up South Australia. Because it didn't just mean connecting up Adelaide, it meant connecting up a whole series of other places. And getting to those places to talk to people, to talk about what they wanted, what they cared about, what they were passionate about, what frustrated them. Those were really important stories to collect and to start to think about when it said, you know, how do we imagine what the future of technology will be, right? And I spent 2 months doing that. It was an extraordinary period in my life. I met a great many South Australians. I heard a lot of wonderful stories. And as I was in the process of pulling together the report, I was thinking about what's the transformation I'm advocating here, right? What is the transformation from a story about technology to a story about people? And I reached out to James and I said, James, I need an image of the internet as technology. Because all I have is pictures of people, right? I have pictures of people using stuff and pictures of people talking. I don't have any pictures of technology. And he came back immediately with this and said, the picture you want of technology is this. And I was like, okay, excellent, what is this? He's like, well, that's Sabernet. I was like, really? It looks very pretty. And it was sort of unexpectedly beautiful, right? We tend to think of technology as just pipes and cables, but there was something about seeing it unraveled this way where you thought, this is actually quite exquisitely lovely. But James and I also had a conversation about this photo, about the fact that it's deceptive to talk about technology as though it were just what they say in the American vernacular, speeds and feeds, that it's just about how fast you can push things down the pipe and how fat the pipe is. And he and I both agreed at the time that that was a terrible way to think about technology. And when I think about the past of the internet, the past of the broadband that James was in no small part building here in South Australia, I realize that we sometimes think about it as being a technological accomplishment. We can say it's, you know, 120 kilometers of wire. We can talk about the speed. But what we forget in that conversation was that even as we were building those networks, we were already talking about what they meant, about who was connected, about what the conversations were that people were having. I now sit in a large American company, in a company whose, in some ways, founding principle is the notion that technology gets smaller and faster and cheaper on an 18-month knowable cadence. And what that, of course, never talks about is what it makes possible. And that conversation already erases the people from it, the people that are making the technology, but also the people that are using it. And so when I think about the past of the internet, it's sometimes really easy to think about it as just a collection of wires and protocols. But it's also about the biographies of the people that were involved. It's about their hopes and dreams. It's about, in some ways, the conversations they imagined that technology would create. I spend a great deal of my time in Silicon Valley now with a conversation about the early days of the internet is a conversation about democracy, a conversation about transparency, a conversation about the fact that the technology would make the information free. All of which are kind of remarkable conversations to contemplate as large technology companies have IPOs, and it's kind of clear that information being free might not actually be the way the market makes sense of the technology today. And we have this really interesting disconnect between the stories we told about the technology and the way it's now used. But for me, when I think about the past of it, it's for me there's always this tension between this notion of what the technology did at a technical level and what it was actually affording at a social and a cultural one. I also think when you talk about the present of technology, and I mean to riff on Ray Bradbury here, who said the future was already here, it was merely unevenly distributed, I realize the present is already here and unevenly distributed too. The photo behind me here was taken outside of Morgan in the Riverland in South Australia. It suggests that the internet is a destination that one perhaps might not need to go to. I mean, there's something quite remarkable about this photo. I use it a lot in the United States, and everyone assumes it's photoshopped. They always congratulate me on my photoshopping skills and then ask why I would stick that sign there. And of course, for me, there's something wonderful about realising that even as we talk today about the fact that the internet is a global technology and it is a technology of huge potential, it's still not everywhere. And it's still not everywhere in places we think of as already being hyper-connected. And the notion here of the internet as a destination is incredibly provocative. But there's something about the idea of, particularly in Australia, right, where signs connote things. You won't know this yet, Ethan, but we have an entire, effectively signage as forms of advice, mostly which could be cribbed as everything here will kill you. I think of all the signs on every beach, the snakes will kill you, the tide will kill you, the rip will kill you, don't step off the path, and then, of course, bathrooms and historic monuments, and in this case, the internet. What's wonderful is you follow this sign in Morgan, it gets increasingly difficult to imagine where the internet is. Because you follow it into town, and then it says the internet in 500 metres, 250 metres, and then there's just a building on which the word written internet. And, of course, when you get there and knock on the door, the man's like, no, I turned it off. Excellent. You're like, the internet is a destination, but it's not open on Sundays. So thinking here about what it means to imagine a technology that is all-pervasive is, in fact, to deceive ourselves, because the technology is also tied up with people. It's tied up with the rhythms of our lives. It's tied up with buildings. It's tied up with structures and the fact that people take Sundays off. And what it means to imagine a technology that's all-pervasive is, in some ways, to imagine a world that's not populated by people. And so what it means for me to think about the present of technology is to think about a technology that is always going to be uneven. Not that it won't be present, but that it will be a layering effect. In some places, it's going to be 3G on a cell phone. In some places, it might be an iPad and a tablet. In some places, it will be a cyber cafe you visit. And in other places, it will be a really pretty boring Nokia feature phone where you connect to the internet and the internet is text-based. And oh, by the way, it only works when you're in town. So imagining that what it means to talk about the internet is never to talk about a system where everything is going to be evenly distributed, but will always be unevenly distributed, is for me as a researcher actually what makes it an interesting world, and is something I know Ethan will talk a lot more about momentarily. It's also the case I now spend my time in many kind of strategic conversations in American industry, and everyone has been talking about the fact that the PC is dead. I've heard this phrase a lot now. We're in the post-PC era, the PC is dead. I realize this is a bit like saying we're in a post-paper period or the end of cash. It turns out the PC is remarkably stubborn. People may not think it's sexy anymore, but it hasn't gone anywhere. And much like some of the things we have called dead well ahead of time, like paper and cash, it turns out they persist in important ways. Tooth fairy doesn't take credit cards. It's really hard to leave post-it notes digitally because no one can see them. It turns out there are things that paper and cash, and one will argue PCs, are always going to do. So as we think about the future and the present, I often think as a scholar we need to be careful about the stories we tell and about how real they really are, and about the kind of catchphrases that move across the boundaries between policy and marketing to imagine what the realities really are. And as we think about what it means to imagine a world of connected people, again, it's not all going to be in a post-PC world. There are still going to be these kind of huge infrastructures that are incredibly important, and all the other ways we know that people are going to connect to technology are part of both the present and the future of the internet and of broadband and of all the kind of the legacy of things that are interesting. It also means that there's an increasing conversation going on both in Australia and I would say on the global stage about what we're doing with all this technology. I spend a lot of time in people's homes around the world, and I hear a persistent and lingering anxiety about what it means for people to be constantly connected. And whether it's an anxiety manifested in, my child has turned six, should I get them a mobile phone? I want to take the iPad away, but then they scream in the back of the car. I'm really worried my child knows how to use the iPad and I don't, and she's two. What will it mean for our language that everyone is now speaking in text messaging and emoticons? We manifest this incredible, in some ways, anxiety about what the technology will bring forward. We talk about what it means for people to be connected, to be hyper-connected. We worry about what the nature of that connectivity is, what people are connecting to, and to whom and under what circumstances. Now, in some ways, those are remarkably persistent anxieties. We worried about the same things when the telephone came along, and when electricity came along, and when television came along, and when radio came along, and even when electricity came along. There is a wonderful exchange in the American Congress back in the 19-teens between a series of seated American congressional figures and a woman who was advocating for the electrifying of the American suburbs. And she was arguing that you should electrify American homes because it would change the dynamic. It would let women go and work. It would let women go into education. So it's sort of an interesting argument that a woman named Christine Frederick was making. And the senators at the time questioned her and said, didn't she believe that electricity would in fact make women and children vulnerable? She was like, why? They're like, well, if you lit up the homes, people would know they were home. She was like, yes. They're like, and then bad people will get them. She was like, so let me see if I understand this. You electrify homes and the predators will come to the people in the homes because now you can see them. And the senator said, yes. And she said, I don't think so. And this remarkable exchange ensued about what it meant to imagine electrifying homes and how you could do it and keep women and children safe. In some ways, that discourse shouldn't sound surprising because it's the same one we've had about a whole range of new technologies as they've been introduced, and the anxiety always lands in the same place. And it turns out I think there is something about the moral anxiety that accompanies technology. And any technology that threatens to do three things always invokes that anxiety. If it threatens to rearrange our relationships to time, our relationships to space, and our relationships to other people. And as soon as a technology has that potential, we immediately imagine nothing good will come of it. And it is usually followed by phrases like, it will be the end of our society, it will be the death of our culture, have you seen what the young people are doing? It's never good. What's fascinating for me is the persistence of this anxiety and the fact that you can read the accounts of electricity and rock and roll and the internet and hear exactly the same anxiety running through all of them. Because what they are is technologies that rearrange social relationships. And they rearranged our relationships to each other and to the places we were from. And those are powerful forces, and they're always accompanied by fear. And one of the things that I think is most remarkable as someone who gets to dip in and out of South Australia was the way we have managed that particular set of anxieties in a little bit of a different way. And for me, one of the things about dealing with James and about dealing with Sabrenet and about dealing with the conversations about the internet here is there's always been a slight more willingness to understand that that was an anxiety, not a truth. And that you can recognize the anxiety and work through it and think about what it means to build capacity and to teach kids how to behave on the internet and to think about what all of those things mean without necessarily needing to succumb to the fact that it's the end of the world as we know it. So for me, playing through those anxieties is always an incredibly important part of the puzzle of both the present and the, you know, the sort of promised future. It's also the case that I think the world is very different than it was when Sabrenet was first imagined back in 2002. Starting in 2000 and really by 2002, about 70% of the world's population that was online was in America. That's 70. By today, less than 15% of the world's internet users are in America. The fastest growing languages online are Bengali and Arabic and Hindi and Spanish and Chinese. The biggest sites of internet production are happening in places in some ways far from here about things that aren't necessarily in languages we read. It's also the case that when Sabrenet was first getting going, the most obvious way to connect to the internet was through a desktop or a laptop. Now there are a myriad of devices that connect us to the internet, and the internet is different on each one of those. Whether it is as a delivery pipe on a Kindle or as a back end in a smart electrical meter, whether it's what the internet looks like on your phone or a tablet or a computer or arguably in your car or in smart signage, the internet has become many things. The technology industry, however, stubbornly clings to the notion there will be one device. It's like the Tolkien fantasy, one device to rule them all. And if we can just find that one device, it'll be great. And every time a new device turns up, they go, this is it. Everyone is going to abandon everything else. And my lab and I sit there going, really? Have you unpacked anyone's handbag recently? It turns out we didn't abandon it. We just stuffed it in our bags along with everything else. And the reality is when you unpack the handbags and backpacks and cars and houses of many places on this world, you find lots of technology, all of them being used to connect to the internet, all of them for different reasons and different experiences. And imagining that there's one right way anymore gets really pretty complicated. And for most people, there's lots of different choices people make about whether it's a touch-based interface they like or something that doesn't need certain kinds of virus protection or if it's a phone because you don't have to share it with your parents. There's lots of different ways that we are connecting. And what that means for regulation, among other things, is incredibly complicated. This is no longer a single beast anymore, right? It is many. And of course, last but by no means least for me is the fact that we're now talking about new models of engagement. About 8 months ago, a piece of video turned up on YouTube, from which this is a screen grab. You may wonder why this is here. This is a little 47-second video, really of great happiness as far as I'm concerned, because what it is a Furby, which is the large digital toy in the background. You may remember these from the 1990s. They were hateful. They squeaked a lot, they rolled their eyes, they fluttered their eyelashes and wiggled their ears and attempted to engage in some form of communication, most of it atonal. In the foreground of this image is an Apple iPhone with Siri, personal digital assistant, running on top of it. In this 47-second clip, someone starts the Furby up and the Furby goes, and Siri says, "Would you like me to call Shell Oil?" And the Furby says, and Siri says, "I don't think I understand." And the Furby goes, "Ah." And it says, "Would you like me to call Graham?" And this goes on for 47 seconds of bliss and happiness of miscommunication. Clearly the person who put this together thought this was quite funny, and indeed it is. But for me it said something really interesting, was that here we were at this moment where something had really happened powerfully. When I saw this, I mean, as an anthropologist, I couldn't help but see this as a genealogy, right, of things that talked. So there's the Furby as the kind of the first generation of talking digital stuff. And there's the Siri, most recent generation of talking digital stuff. And I'm sure the person who put it there was basically trying to say these were equally unhelpful, talking digital things. What I realized, however, was the really powerful thing about this was that what it was that the Siri was, well, the Furby was making noise. And the Siri, it wasn't that it was talking, it was that it was listening. And the listening is the really interesting thing. Because however imperfect it is, you know, it doesn't understand a Furby. I don't know if that's a detraction or a good thing, frankly. However imperfect it is, what it promises is the prospect that you might be listened to by an object. Not that it is talking at you, but listening. And the listening is the promise of something quite different than we've had in our relationships from technology in the past. And I think the listening is the promise of a shift here from a moment where we've interacted with technology to a moment where we will have relationships with technology. Now, whenever I say that to my American engineering colleagues, they immediately say to me, when the machines are smart enough to have a relationship with us, they'll kill us. Persistently. And I'm like, really? They're like, yes, the Terminator. I'm like, that's a movie. They're like, how? Space Odyssey. I'm like, also a movie based on science fiction. They're like, Blade Runner. I'm like, based on a short story, also fiction. They're like, but that's what will happen. I'm like, really? They're like, yes. I'm like, okay. So I go to my colleagues in Japan, and I'm like, so you have robots? They're like, yes. I'm like, do you think they're going to kill you? They're like, why would we think the robots were going to kill us? I'm like, well, because they do in America. They're like, that's just a movie. I'm like, okay, good. So my Japanese colleagues and I got into a conversation about what would it mean to imagine that objects might take care of you, and they looked at me and said, but they already are. We have robots in our nursing homes. We have robots in our schools. We can fully imagine a world in which there is a relationship between people and technology. The future that you're talking about is already here. And for me, what I'm fascinated by is what comes next. Right? And I'm fascinated by thinking about the world that James built, the broadband that he built, and the promise that he was making about what comes next. And for me, this notion that we're moving from a world of technology that we have to do all the work for, we have to plug them in, we have to update them, we have to give them passwords and networks, and it's just a lot of palaver. That would be work. It's a lot of palaver looking after these machines. But imagine they can start to, A, look after themselves, and B, start to look after us and not kill us. Is this promise of a remarkably different way of thinking about what we might be with technology as we move forward? And really what I wanted to end it was with that, but also with this notion that for me, as I think about the broadband that James was building, the broadband that many of us in this room are implicated in building, for me it's about how we empower everyone, where that empowerment is going to look like different things for different people. In some places, it's about citizenship. In other places, it's going to be about consumption and consumerism. For some people, it's going to be about creativity. For other people, it's going to be about political resistance. But whatever it's going to take, it's about how we build a system and sustain a system that makes those things possible. And for me, that's not just about the technology. It's about how we capacity build in our citizens. It's how we create the possibilities and the prospects, and also the imagination to think about how it might be different. And for me, that was what James always brought, was the prospect of how it might be different and the reality of actually building it. So I'm incredibly pleased that we all get to be here to celebrate that. And with that, I want to turn it over to my dear friend and colleague, Ethan, for his first big outing in Australia, so you have to be kind to him. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here for all sorts of different reasons. For one, I've been a huge Genevieve Bell fan for years and have never quite understood her, and I understand her much better now having come to South Australia. So I'm grateful for that. It's wonderful to be here. I'm here from MIT. We have many, many robots. Very few of them want to kill you. So I just wanted to sort of clarify on all of that. we did sort of agree on this theme of talking about sort of past, present, and future. And in thinking about James Tysett, who I didn't know, unfortunately, I wanted to honor sort of the vision of a man who was very interested in building networks to bring machines together. And when you think about networks, people often talk about connecting machines. So this is actually sort of the diagram of the internet. This is actually an accurate picture of what the internet looked like in 1969. It's four different machines. They're actually represented by their names. There's a System 360 from IBM over there at UC Santa Barbara and different machines at different places. And they're all tied together through networks. And network engineers will sort of look at this and say, this is more or less the same thing that we do these days. We try to figure out how to take computers in different parts of the world, and we put wires between them, and then interesting things happen. And the interesting thing that happened with this network is that it ended up being used for something completely different than what it was intended for. When it was put together in 1969, the whole idea was that you had engineers at these different universities who wanted to use each other's computers. Because these computers were these massive, expensive things that you never got to touch, you never got to play with. And if you were lucky enough to have one of them, you would never have a second or a third. So you would want to try the other one out that the other guy had at the other university. And so that was the idea between bringing these things together. But by 1971, so literally 2 years into the history of the internet, most of the traffic going back and forth in this network wasn't people using each other's computers, it was email. It was people talking to one another. And this shouldn't actually have surprised anybody, because 5 years before you had an internet, you actually had email. At my university, at MIT, you had a massive computer that was shared by about 100 different researchers, and they built themselves an email system despite the fact that they were all literally in the same place using the same machine over and over and over. So whenever we talk about bringing machines together, what we're really talking about in some ways is bringing people together. It's an incredibly deep impulse that we come to almost every time we sort of sit down in front of a computer. This is Minitel. This is what the internet would have looked like had French telecom bureaucrats invented it. And so this is what they tried to do. This was 1982 in France. And France Telecom sort of gave people these machines, and the whole idea was it was much better than a phone book. There were all sorts of little things you could do on it. One of the big features they touted on this was a chess program. And you could plug this in, and you could play computer chess. This was pretty cool in 1982. This was pretty sophisticated. And the people who put it together got terribly worried. They assumed that the chess program was broken, because they would look at their logs, and what would happen is people would come in, they would make one move, and then they wouldn't make another move. They would play a single move of chess, pawn to queen four, nothing else would happen. And what happened was, when they built the chess program, they built in a very primitive chat system associated with it, basically so you could talk smack to the person that you were playing with. And what people figured out as early as 1982 was that all you had to do was go in and say pawn to queen four, and then you had an open chat line. And you could chat with whoever it was that you wanted to talk to. And that's what people found a way to do, even despite the fact that no one had sort of started instant messaging. So by the time I find myself addicted, thoroughly, thoroughly addicted to the internet, in the late 1980s, the internet looks a little bit like this. It's sort of like the spaceport bar in Star Wars. And the reason it really looks like this bar is that you never know who you're going to run into, what the conversation is going to be. You've got people talking about photography over there. You have people talking about Japanese anime over there. You end up in these conversations. You have no idea whether your interlocutor is in Tokyo, or is in Reykjavik, or is in Adelaide, or is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And it's part of what's so remarkable and sort of special about this internet. Now, the other thing to remember is that this is the late 1980s. So the truth is, as cosmopolitan as it might feel, as incredibly sort of diverse as you might imagine it is, pretty much the only people you're talking to are grad students. Because the only people using the internet are grad students. That's it. It's sort of grad students all the way down at that point. But it feels incredibly sexy. It feels like you could meet anyone from anywhere else. You know, I found myself meeting a friend who's remained a friend for years, because we were both heading off to West Africa to work together. And we found each other on the internet before we both headed out in 1993. And to me, this was the sense of, wow, you know, the internet brought Africa to me, despite the fact that what it really did was introduce me to another undergraduate in American university rather than to an actual African. So there was a lot of illusion very early on in the internet. When we sort of go back into this past, when we go into, say, the late 80s, the early 1990s, there's a strain of thought that we now talk about as cyber-utopianism, this sort of naive belief that once we had networks, some fundamental changes to society would come about. The first change was that information would just be incredibly pervasive. We'd have access to whatever we wanted to know anywhere in the world at any moment in time. That suddenly, because everyone could be on these networks, and it didn't matter where you were coming from, what your background was, you could participate in the conversation, that we would have this incredible wealth of deliberation. We would have this ability to totally transform politics and govern ourselves in different ways through direct conversation. And that we would be connected to everybody on the planet. That eventually we'd hit the point where you could sort of reach out and have a conversation with any other person out there. Now, we've now hit a point where it's very reasonable to sort of look at these questions and ask ourselves, how are we doing? And I would argue on the first score, we're actually not doing badly. I think if you look at the combination of sort of crowdsourced things like Wikipedia, and you look at commercial solutions like Google, which in a very strange way is actually a crowdsourced thing, right? I mean, Google helps you find things, but what it's actually helping you find is something that someone else has already written. So in that sense of the internet putting enormous amounts of human knowledge and making it accessible, it comes out in really weird and subtle ways. I found myself in Melbourne Saturday, watching a version of a game called football, which didn't resemble any version of football I'd ever seen before. I'd seen rugby football, I'd seen FIFA football, we have American football played by guys who look like me. This one looked like none of those. And I found myself talking with some young men from Sydney who were watching this team in orange really just get slaughtered. I felt very, very bad. Greater Western Sydney. I know. I thought I would joke. I'd put the colors out there. Thank you very much. And we were trying to decide for this utterly dismal game how many people were in the stadium. And we were arguing about the capacity of the stadium. And finally, one of the guys said, this is what they invented Google for, and pulled out his phone and very quickly figured out that Docklands Stadium holds 53,000 people and therefore was one-third full, and that was about appropriate for this. It's an incredibly trivial example, but we are growing up with a generation of people who never have that moment of sort of saying, gee, I really wish I could know this. And if it's a simple fact that we don't have it at hand, we always have it at hand. And that experience of that sort of cocktail party conversation, or the conversation over beers of, you know, how big is this, how large is this, we're never going to have it again. So as far as simple fact, we're there. As far as more complicated knowledge, still getting tricky. But I would say on this score, we've done fairly well. Deliberation side of this, we've done dismally. It turns out that being more connected to one another, more people having voices, probably makes it worse rather than making it better. It may actually make it harder to come to consensus. You're trying to listen to everybody. Everyone wants a turn to speak. All sorts of dynamics, who's ever loudest, who's ever the most passionate ends up having more power. That turns out to be a deeply human problem, not a technological problem. The third problem is the one that I'm obsessed with, which is this sort of question of who we're connected to and really who we're not connected to. And I'm obsessed with this in part because I've spent an enormous amount of my professional life hanging out in West Africa. I've done lots and lots of work in the country of Ghana since 1993. I've been going back and forth at least once a year since then. I started going to this country at a point where I was one of the first three people in the country. It's a country of 20 million people. One of the first three people in the country online in 1993. We're now at a point where this country is so well connected to the rest of the world that I'm watching the upcoming presidential elections on Twitter because the candidates are tweeting, their parties are tweeting, my friends who are monitoring the election are tweeting, all the NGOs who have different perspectives on it, the debates are being live streamed and live tweeted. You know, I can be fully involved with this country's politics despite the fact that I'm quite distant from it. It's an incredible transformation. It's been an incredible moment where we've gone from maybe 150,000 people online to now about 2.2 billion people connected to high-speed internet,
about 5.6 billion people with mobile phones worldwide. And that question of being on the internet and being on the phone are literally just merging. We're getting to the point where it's not even a meaningful distinction anymore. When you talk about the percentage of human population that you could theoretically have a connection to, it's rapidly approaching 100%. This isn't to say that we don't have the places where the internet is still a kilometer away, but we're rapidly getting to the point where things can change. It's incredible to go from a country where literally you would have to queue to make a phone call, and I made 4 phone calls the first year that I lived in Ghana, to one where I can't get my phone to stop ringing when I'm over there and visiting. And so this leads us to a world that starts looking a little bit like this map. And I actually want to spend a moment or two on this map because it's incredibly deceptive and incredibly important to actually start to sort of figure it out. This is a map that an intern put together 2 summers ago at Facebook. And it was a way of looking at relationships on Facebook. And so for each person on Facebook that they traced, and they traced about 1,000 people chosen at random, they did all the people that that person knows. The average person knows about 130 people on Facebook. So if you start with 1,000, you end up with about 130,000 points of data, and you draw a little arc between all of them. And the first thing you get when you look at this is you sort of go, wow, this is amazing. Now we've got a network that is literally connecting everybody on the planet. It connects every corner of the globe. And I want to try to dispel that for you. First of all, I want to point out there are some large chunks of the world that simply don't show up. China, it's kind of a big country. It's up there. It's kind of a big blue spot up there. You might have heard of it. It's sort of important. Has about 500 million internet users, no Facebook users, in part because the government blocks it, in part because China actually has other social networks that work very well, and there's a very good chance that even if Facebook were available in China, you wouldn't have a lot of users of it. The other thing that I want to point out is that you see highly populated areas of this map light up bright white. And that's because the concentration of local connection is so much higher and so much richer than these international connections. You can't even see the lines anymore. They basically just blur into these sort of spots of light. We, even in a digital age, are much more connected to the people that we know, the people in our local communities, the people in our home countries, than we are connected to people elsewhere. And that shouldn't be a surprise. If you think about what happens when you join Facebook, the first thing it says is, who did you go to school with? Who have you worked with? Who do you already know? Let me help you connect to those people that you already know. The internet becomes the way to stay in touch with people that you know from the real world. Now, this is a crazy change in about 20 years. When I found myself getting online, the internet was never going to connect me to the people at the small college that I was at because none of them were on the internet. It was to connect me to the crazy people who were only online, who cared about these things that I cared about, and that I had the chance to reach out and encounter. But we've completely changed that assumption over the course of about 20 years. And now we assume that what this technology is really good for is connecting us to the people that we know and that we're closest to and most familiar with. There's always been the role of technologies in telling us about the rest of the world. Historically, we get our knowledge about the rest of the world through media, through curated media. So whether that's through a newspaper, whether that's through a television broadcast, someone goes out and says, here's what's out there and what's important in the world. And historically, this has been a really difficult, expensive, dangerous thing to do. It's required physically putting people out there with cameras and shooting film and shipping it back and developing it and putting it on the airwaves. And all of that's changed. And what's funny about it is that despite the fact that reporting on the rest of the world has gotten so cheap and so easy that you can do it from a mobile phone, you can hold it up and be live to the internet immediately, we actually get much less international news in our media. And this is a trend that we're seeing in a number of different countries. We're seeing it in the UK, where the 4 major newspapers have actually decreased the amount of international coverage that they've had 45% over the last 40 years. In the US, the amount of a newscast that's international has gone from being about 40% to about 12% over the last 30 years. The internet makes it better a little bit. I can go and I can read Ghanaian newspapers and sort of say, well, that's great. If you're not going to tell me about Ghana, at least I can go there directly. But I'm a rounding error. And if you actually look at what media people look at, even in a digital age, the vast majority is local. We might go online, we might look at the Times of India, we might look at the New York Times, we might look at the BBC. You don't. And I have the numbers. You guys are actually better than the US and the UK. The US and the UK are about 95% domestic. It's about 84% domestic in Australia. But it's predominantly looking to the local. So again, we have more and more connectivity, but we also have more and more interest in what's in our backyard. So fortunately, now we start having search. We have the ability to pick exactly what we want, go out, find exactly whatever information you want to know. If you come out of this and you're fascinated by Ghana, you want to know more, you can go out and do it. But then the responsibility is on you. How do you decide what you want to know about the rest of the world? You can go to the salad bar and put whatever you want on your salad, but it's your responsibility to choose. And that's what search is. Search essentially says, you know what you want to know. You know what you need to know about the rest of the world. Go out and get it. And you get to select it, and you'll be more free and you'll be more happy because you have the choice. But you also know how the responsibility for putting it together. So when you see the rise of things like Facebook, it really has to do with many of us essentially saying, I'm not sure this is working. I don't necessarily want that responsibility all the time. Sometimes I don't know what I want to know. And so what we do instead is we ask our friends, hey, what do you know? Maybe if I knew what you knew, I would discover something novel. I would discover something really interesting. And so we go onto these social networks and we sort of say, what's new? What's fun? What can you tell me about the world? And we get some interesting information, but we get some limits to that information. And the reason there are limits to that information is that the people that we're finding on these networks tend to be a lot like us. They tend to be from the same country as us. They tend to speak the same language that we do. They tend to have the same religion. They tend to have the same ethnicity. We end up falling victim to what sociologists call homophily, which is basically a fancy way of saying that birds of a feather flock together. So we've gone from this world where much of our information is coming through curators, through someone who's basically saying, here's what you might need to know about the world. We've gone into search, where we basically say, you know best, go figure out what you want to know about the world. Now we're going through this phase of social, where we basically say, well, maybe my friends will help me figure out what's going on in the rest of the world. And the problem is that none of these necessarily prepare us to live in a world that's as connected as the one that we actually live in. This matters, and the reason that I care about this is at least threefold. One is that it's potentially dangerous to live in a world where we're deeply connected and we don't know what all those connections are. You suddenly find yourself worrying about things like avian flu. You find yourself asking questions about what do people eat in Singapore, because it turns out that people in Singapore get on airplanes, and suddenly you have the possibility of a disease that might have been incredibly localized and could have been really devastating for one particular population, suddenly becomes a global crisis. And if you don't have a way of looking at pandemic, if you don't have a way of looking at international terror networks, if you don't have a way of looking at very complicated financial flows from a multinational perspective, very, very bad things can end up happening. You also have the possibility that if what we're mostly getting is information from people who are like us, that we end up getting highly polarized. There's a pair of books, very helpful. One is put together by a constitutional law scholar in the US named Cass Sunstein. He put forward this book that basically offers a theory called the echo chamber. He says that if you're only getting information from people who agree with you, you tend to become more polarized in your views. And this is a phenomenon called confirmation bias. If everyone over and over and over says, well, this point of view is the right one, eventually it becomes very hard for you to think about the fact that there might be another point of view. You put people who are politically to one side of the spectrum together with other people in a room, and they actually all gravitate further to the right or further to the left. When we hang out with people who think the way we do, we get more like them. And there's an argument that in societies that are getting more politically polarized, this is part of what's going on. My friend Eli Pariser went ahead and wrote a book that argues that this is getting even worse because the technologies are making it easier to do it. So it's not just that we can choose to hang out with people on the left. It's not even just that Google News can suddenly say, let me only give you news from the left. It's that even if you go out and you try to look for people who have another point of view, Facebook's going to fight you. And it's mostly going to give you information from the people that you pay attention to and that you care the most about, and you're going to get even more polarized from it. And these guys are both right, but they're missing the point in some ways. This isn't just about left-right. The filter bubble's three-dimensional. We have bubbles in terms of where we're from, what we think, whether we're identifying as Australians or identifying as Americans. We end up getting trapped in that identity. And it's very, very hard for us to see the perspective of someone who's from a different country, who speaks a different language, who views the world in a very, very different way. So we end up getting polarized in terms of how we see ourselves as a nation rather than how other people are seeing themselves as citizens of the world. The third reason that I think we ought to care about this is that historically connecting to other cultures, other points of view, has been one of the most amazing sources of inspiration. Before Picasso was Picasso, he spent an enormous amount of time hanging out in African art museums in Paris. And if you read about his time there, he really didn't like them. He actually writes about how scary and how smelly and how foreign they were and how he didn't want to encounter them, but something ended up speaking to him, and he became an incredible collector of masks, mostly from Benin. And shortly after he starts collecting these masks, his style changes radically. And you start seeing these faces in Picasso that have these flat surfaces. And it's very clear where it's coming from. That's referred to as his African period. It's basically where Cubism starts emerging. It turns out that creativity is basically an import-export business. Creativity has a lot to do with finding ideas in a different part of the world and bringing them into a different context. And so if we're heading towards a world where we're not able to go out and find those other ideas, not because we can't, but because we don't remember to, we have this incredible possibility of missed potential. So I've been working on this for a few years now. I've got a project called Global Voices. It's about 8 years old. It does some fairly interesting things. It basically looks at what people are saying with social media in different parts of the world. So if you come out of this and you're interested in Ghana, you can go online and you can find out what Ghanaians are saying and talking about and what those debates are. When they're talking in local languages like Chui, we're translating it so you can go and read it, you can pay attention to it. We've got about 800 people doing this at this point, putting this out on a website that's got free content. We actually just got about 300 people together in Kenya a couple of weeks ago to have sort of a conversation about where the project is going. What's interesting about it is we're learning that you can use the internet, if you choose to, in at least three different ways. It turns out that the internet can be very, very effective as a window, as a bridge, and as a cafe. This is an analogy actually brought to us by someone who was involved with our community very early on, a guy named Hossein Darakhshan. If you follow international human rights, you may have heard the name. Unfortunately, Hossein is in prison in Iran and has been for the last 3 years, locked up for blogging. But he was involved with our community very early on, and this was actually an analogy that he brought to talk about what he thought blogs were doing for Iran. He felt like blogs could give you a window. You could look in and see Iranian society, but much of the time you wouldn't understand what was going on. That they could act as bridges. You could have people sort of say, look, I get it, you don't understand Iran, let me try to explain it to you. Let me try to bring you a little closer to it. Let's have a conversation about it. And the conversation is the cafe, part of the metaphor. Let's get together and let's actually talk about what this might mean. So we've been trying to do this for a while now on this site, and it turns out that you can get a lot of this done. You can translate, you can bridge, you can make content a lot accessible. We're not the only ones doing this. For those of you who are interested in China, the missing part of the map back there, there's an amazing site out there called Tea Leaf Nation, which tries very hard to translate what's going on in Chinese social media for English-speaking readers. So there's people trying to do it, and it turns out that that's not really the problem. The real problem is that the internet gives us what we want. And what we want isn't always what we need. And what we probably need to do is start thinking about what happens technologically if we always get what we want. If we're able to go and get the information that we want, if we're able to interact with the people that we're most comfortable with, most familiar with, what does this do to us in the long term? So in the space of past, present, and future, I really feel like we're going to look at this moment in time and sort of say it's amazing in many ways, and it's really disappointing in some ways. And the way I think it's disappointing is that we're using these technologies in many ways that aren't really challenging ourselves. It's not challenging ourselves to take on different views. It's not challenging ourselves to look at different parts of the world. And I think the big thing we're missing is the possibility of serendipity. That experience of unexpected discovery is not something that happens by accident. You look at someone like Alexander Fleming, right? And the story that gets told about Fleming is that he got luckier than any other guy out there. He had some petri dishes, some mold fell in it, and poof, antibiotics, he changed the entire world, right? That's a really dumb way to think about Alexander Fleming's story. You have to work really hard to get that lucky. You know, this was a guy who was growing enormous amounts of bacteria, was studying bacteria. He was the perfect person to have a spore of mold fall into the dish. He had put himself in the perfect experience to have that serendipitous discovery. Now, there's luck in there. You have to find the fungus that kills off the bacteria, but you also have to be smart enough to sort of know what happens. And I think one of the things that we're going to see going forward is that we're going to see people trying to engineer serendipity. And I think this is one of the most powerful things we can think about doing with our technology. It has everything to do with looking at what we already know, looking at what ground we're already walking over and over again, and trying to figure out what else is out there that's interesting, that's provocative, that's important, that we're not paying attention to. It's the dead opposite of what we end up doing. We've built 1,000 systems that say, Ethan, you are similar to Genevieve Bell. And Genevieve Bell really likes this book. You should like this book. And the answer is, you know what? That's right. I probably really will like that book. That works at an incredible level. But it's incredibly limiting. What you really need is something that says, Ethan and Genevieve, you guys aren't paying any attention to Nigeria. And a lot of Nigerians really like this book. And this might be the book that you actually want to pay attention to. But what this all comes down to is this fundamental idea of rewiring the net. We've built an internet that's incredibly good at doing some things. It's incredibly good at letting people publish information and share it. It's incredibly good at helping people find what they're looking for. And every time we build a tool, these tools have politics behind them. They have agendas. And I don't mean evil agendas. I don't mean hidden, you know, dark secret agendas. I just mean agendas. All technology, whether it's the Furby or whether it's anything else, has some sort of agenda behind it. And we have to get very good at figuring out what our technology makes easy to do, what it makes hard to do, and if we don't like where it's going, we have this option to rewire it. What's wonderful about this is that we're only 20 or so years into the internet being used by the general public. If we don't like how it works, and if we're not happy with what we're getting out of it, we can choose something different. So that's the vision that I wanted to put going forward. And now maybe we can talk a little bit about it.
I hope so. Thank you. Wow. I don't even know where to start with all of that. Actually, I do have a question, which is I was thinking about as I was listening to you talk. And I realize it's always the best part about getting on stage with someone is you can just ask them all the things you've been thinking about and you've just not been brave enough to. How did you get into all of this? Like, why this?
Well, I ended up feeling like it was a lucky break.
Were you working very hard to be that lucky?
No, I actually think it was the opposite of it, right? So I basically did two things in college. I took a degree in philosophy, but I didn't actually do philosophy. I did two things. I did African drumming. And I hung out on the internet. And the reason I hung out on the internet was that late in high school, in secondary school, I was dating a woman who was in California. I was in Massachusetts. It's the cheapest way to stay in touch. And so to stay in touch, I became sort of an expert on this nascent global network. And, you know, the idea that this would suddenly become a marketable skill and that someone would care about this was approximately as lucky as someone sort of showing up and saying, we're looking for someone who really knows how to drink beer. Drinking beer and watching sport, if you're good at that, you know, we have a wonderful job for you. And for me, it sort of felt like that level of luck.
I'm mesmerized by that job now. What is that job?
I don't know. We should find it. But it was a wonderful time. You know, the early 1990s was a wonderful time to actually know something about the internet because you were one of the very few who did it. But it's a better question for you. I mean, you're an anthropologist. You spent your time mucking about in difficult places and being uncomfortable and eating inedible food. And what ended up sort of deciding that the internet was the place to study rather than studying in the field?
Well, so, you know, child of an anthropologist. Many of you know my mother is a well-known Australian anthropologist, so I spent my childhood in Northern Territory in the 70s and 80s, and I ran away from Australia to go to university. Stayed to go to graduate school because they were paying for it. That seemed like a good idea. Ended up at Stanford in the 1990s, so I was at Stanford between 92 and 97, so in the sort of the insane dot-com build-up, but still doing really classic anthropology. So Native American studies, I'd been hanging out in a series of indigenous communities, talking about boarding schools. I mean, not the kind of thing that propels you to a tech company. And then good Australian fashion, I met a man in a bar in Palo Alto in 1998. He asked me what I did. I had had at least a beer. So I told him I was an anthropologist. And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "Something that he'd always needed." Because that seemed like a good answer. And he said, "Really?" I said, "Yes." He said, "So what exactly is anthropology again?" That it was the study of people and culture and, you know, stuff like that. And he's like, "So what are you doing with that then?" I'm like, "Well, I'm teaching at Stanford." He's like, "But you study people." I was like, "Yeah." He's like, "Don't you think you could do more?" I'm like, "Wow." And at the time, I remember thinking, I don't even know how to answer that question, right? What is more? I have a classroom. I love teaching. And he's like, "Well, if you're actually good with understanding people, you could do more." And I remember thinking, "You're a very difficult man. I must stop talking to you now." And so I left. And then he called me the next day, which was odd, because my mother had told me not to give my number to strange men in bars, and I hadn't. And it was 1998, so it was before Google and LinkedIn and Facebook and any way you could have... There was no box on the internet into which you could have typed, "Redheaded Australian anthropologist." There was nothing like that. And I pick up the telephone in my apartment, Genevieve Bell. He's like, "Hi, I'm the man from the bar last night." I'm like, "How did you find me?" was my first question. And he's like, "Well, I called all the anthropology departments in the Bay Area." I was like, I'm thinking, okay, Berkeley, Stanford, UC Santa Cruz, San Francisco State, good, so you had to work for it, that's good. And I was like, what did you ask for? He said, "Well, I asked them if they had any, you know, redheaded Australian anthropologist." I said, "And?" He said, "Well, Stanford gave me your name and your home phone number." I'm like, "Okay, so what can I do for you exactly?" He's like, "Well, you seem very interested." I'm like, "Listen, I don't want to be rude, but I'm not at all interested in you." He's like, "Oh, not like that." I'm like, "Why are you calling?" He's like, "Well, I want to give you a job." And I'm like, "Doing what?" He's like, "I don't know, but you seem interesting." I'm like, "Okay, Silicon Valley is weird." I said to him, "I'm like, Bob, you're weird." He's like, "I'll buy you lunch." I'm like, "I'm a graduate student. That sounds like an excellent idea." So he took me to lunch. At lunch, he explained to me again, I seemed interesting. And I kept going, "Yes, but, and?" He's like, "Well, that's really it." I'm like, "Okay." And so I let him buy me lunch on a semi-regular basis. He introduced me to a bunch of people in the Valley, including the guys at Intel, who decided that also I seemed interesting, which was nice to hear, but not really relevant. And Intel then uttered even better words than "I'll buy you lunch," which is, "I'll fly you to a city you've never been to before." I was like, "Excellent." So I get on a plane, I fly to Portland. I have a job interview. At this point, Intel is a microprocessor company, so they make small silicon wafers. They have decided that they're at a moment where the people running the company and the people they want to sell stuff to look less and less like each other. So the senior decision makers, mostly American-based engineers, the people they're selling to, well, everyone else. And they decided there was a disconnect. And they thought, we need someone to help us bridge the disconnect. And so they'd hired some psychologists, and that hadn't worked out so well for them. They'd hired a sociologist. That hadn't worked out well either. Sorry. And then they said, well, maybe we should get an anthropologist. Maybe that will help. And Bob had said, "Oh, I know one of those." And so I go up. No one has said to me what this job is because there isn't a job description. I give what is a classic academic job talk. I read a paper from paper. Engineers in the room go, "It's excellent." That goes on for an hour. After that, they then give me this full round of interviews, right, where I just get shunted into rooms and people appear and ask me questions and then leave again. And this is 1998. They had just discovered behavioral-based interviewing in this lab, which was good, except that they thought that meant you should subject the candidate to the behaviour you were interested in understanding their response to, not ask them how they responded when subjected to it. This turns out to be a subtle but critical difference. And so for a full morning, people said, blah, 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 and I'd give them an answer like, that's an incredibly stupid answer. I'm like, why'd you ask me then? And after an hour of being polite, I became Australian. So, blah, 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 that's an incredibly stupid answer. I'm like, not half as stupid as the question. And so we did that for a full day, and I got bolshy, and they just seemed that was fine. And at the end of the day, they said, when can you start? I'm like, but I don't want to be here, because you're really just horrible. And so I left. And Intel would call me up every month and go, you know, will you come join us? I'm like, are you less horrible? They're like, we don't know how to answer that. I'm like, well, could you at least tell me what the job would be? They're like, no. And after 6 months, I realized that not knowing what the job was actually incredibly seductive. And at that point, I was, you know, tenure track at Stanford, so I was teaching gig, and I realized that I had 7 years ahead of me doing professorial things. And I knew exactly what that 7 years looked like, right? I mean, month by month, cadence by cadence, you knew exactly what you had to accomplish. And here was this major company who was like, you just seem interesting. I'm like, all right, fine. So I had what you will come to know as a very Australian moment where I went, oh, stuff it. And I called Intel back and joined like 10 days later. My first day on the job, they put me through this mandatory training class where they explained that everything in the factory will kill you. You shouldn't eat anything off the floor. If there's a fire, you should panic. I'm like, okay, well, that's nice. And they'll make me sign a lot of forms. And on day 2, my new boss sits me down and says, great, you're here. We need your help with 2 things. I'm like, for 6 months, you've told me you didn't know what I'd be doing, and now we're down to just 2. She says, yes. I was like, okay, what are those 2 things? So, well, we need your help with women. And I'm like freshly minted academic, right? So I'm like, which women? She's like, all women. I'm like, all 3.2 billion women? She says, yes. So in my notebook of the day, I write women all and underline it several times. And I'm desperately trying to imagine what a project is that would explain women all to a microprocessor company. And then I realized that she said there were 2 things. I'm like, what's the second thing, Chris? She's like, ROW. So I write that down and realize I don't know what that is either. I'm like, Chris, what's ROW exactly? She's like, that's rest of world. I take a very deep breath because I'm pretty certain I'm from rest of world. And I go, so Chris, where is world in this sentence? She's like, that's America. Okay, so just to recap then, you'd like my help with women and everyone else. And she said, yes, that would be good.
It makes the math easy.
Oh, right? Exactly. And I'm like, yeah. But there are 8 other people in this group. What are they doing? And she's like, everything else. I'm like, what is everything else, Chris? She's like, gamers. Oh, and American men. And I was like, I think this is a good gig. And I said, all right, I'm on. And so I think that's what I do. Except at this point, I just include everything.
So to me, what's sort of interesting about this is that it still seems...
involves a man in a bar.
Radical that you would want to study people at a technology company. And the very fact that I'm asking this and that it's a long and engaging story to sort of get there gives us a sense for sort of how crazy we think this is. And I, you know, there may be people in this audience who are sort of wondering why we haven't mentioned routers yet. We can talk routers if you really want to talk routers, but I think we actually are undergoing this sort of shift between thinking about the networks that we're building and thinking about the people who end up using them. And it turns out, and I'll say this as someone who spent 20 years getting very, very deep into technology, because before I started standing on stage and waving my arms about this, I was actually building tech companies. The technology just isn't very interesting. You know, at the end of the day, it's really about, you know, can we put more bits through back and forth in one fashion or another? What's really interesting is what we end up doing with it in one fashion or another. And the things that we end up doing with it more and more are about trying to figure out how does it change our relationship with each other. I thought the thing that you said, that had I been live tweeting here, I would have tweeted several times in different formulations, was this notion that the technologies that really sort of freak us out are the ones that change time, are the ones that change space, and are the ones that change relationships. I would say that the ones that change time and space are really good at disrupting businesses, right? They're really good at sort of saying, you know, that whole long-distance phone business, nah, get rid of it. You know, don't need it anymore. We'll figure out another way to do that. But the ones that change relationships are the ones that actually seem to freak people out. You don't necessarily see people ending up in a moral panic about the ability to sort of time shift on the television so that we can watch without commercials. You know, it's freaking out the advertisers, but it isn't necessarily people talking about whether it's actually going to change civilization. And so what I'm really wondering about is this sort of the change in relationships. That's the essence of political science. It's the essence of sociology. It's the essence of all of these different fields. When does that world cross into this internet world guarded by geeks who demand that you utter, you know, an IPv4 address before you can possibly enter it, and you have to have it memorized ahead of time?
Well, obviously.
192.168.4.8.
Show off.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, partly the answer, ironically enough, is a router story. I know you're going to love that. So Intel in the early days was building Wi-Fi routers, right? We invented, you know, Centrino technology. We landed it on our platforms. We're like, okay, our platforms connect to the internet. Now we're going to need to have something that actually bridges the internet that came into the wall to the thing in our labs. And so there was this technology being built in our labs and many other labs around the world, right? Small box. You remembered it was a box. It was about this big. It had antenna. I was in Singapore, of all places, in 2002, 2003. I was doing field work. I'm in some high-rise apartment complex talking to this Singapore couple, and I'm talking about the IT in their house. And they're like, oh, no, you know, we've got a wireless router. We've got music streaming. It's great. I'm like, oh, how's that been going? Like, you know, it's been really, really fabulous. But about 3 weeks into it, we had this huge problem. I'm like, what was the problem? They're like, well, our printer was possessed. What do you mean the printer was possessed? Like, broken, I understand. Possessed, not so clear. They're like, well, it just started printing things. I'm like, what things? They're like, well, other people's things. I'm like, what people's? They're like, we don't know. Okay. What did you do then? They're like, well, we turned it off, which is always a good impulse, right? Technology breaks. First thing you should do is turn it off and then turn it back on again and see if the problem fixes itself. Works with lots of things. And I was like, then what did you do? They're like, well, then it just kept printing stuff we'd never seen before. Like, then what did you do? And she says, well, I called my father. I'm like, is he an IT expert? She's like, no, he's a feng shui expert. Excellent. So he comes in and says the printer's in the wrong place, which actually turns out to be the right answer. And so the printer keeps printing stuff, and eventually the printer, after 3 days of, you know, behaving like a possessed printer, prints something with a name on it. And the name is clearly two apartments down in the hot apartment complex, right? So they go knock on the door and go, we have your printing. And the man's like, oh, thank God, my printer was possessed. It just wasn't printing anything. Just like, okay, good. And so it turned out what had happened, which not surprised to you, right, is that when the first wireless routers were built, into the object was embedded a notion of what was the size of the right house. So the wireless router had built into it the idea that the house size to which it should broadcast a signal was 100 square meters, or basically 150 square meters, so about the size of an average American house. Now, it turns out, in Singapore, the apartments were about 40 square meters. So basically, one wireless router was now broadcasting to, and you put, and right, multiple problems. If you didn't know that you should securely link things, your printer would just promiscuously go associate with someone else's network. There was just this kind of morass, right? And the engineers at work couldn't work out what the problem was. So a whole lot of stuff got recalled. There were all these conversations because the technology, as far as they were concerned, was working perfectly. And what we had to unpack was, what was the assumption you had built into the technology about how you imagined it was being used that, in fact, broke when it went away from America? In fact, ironically, it also broke in the CEO's house, which was a different problem because his house was 1,000 square meters. And they'd keep building it and coming. He's like, well, it doesn't work over here. And they were like, well, we don't understand why. And then it became a different scale problem, right? But I think, you know, one of the virtues of having, I think, any form of social science and humanity is that it lets you start asking a different set of questions, right? Of that question you ended with, right? Of what would it mean to architect a network for serendipity is different than architecting a network for throughput. Mm-hmm. And, you know, building a wireless router for the Pacific Northwest of America turns out that you've then built a router that doesn't work in Singapore. It also turns out you've not built a router that works actually quite poorly in Australia too, because this, our propensity to want to use the roofing material we use creates a Faraday cage for Wi-Fi. So if it doesn't work well in your house, it turns out your roofing material is frequently to blame, or any corrugated iron anywhere near you is actually creating huge issues, right? So these notions that get embedded in the technology, and I think part of the role of having the sort of research that we do is about how you start to unpack those things, and if we do it right, and we don't always, it's about how do you stop those assumptions from ever being embedded in the first place, right? So at the moment that you're making the technology, how do you ask the questions about who might use it, Because sometimes that provokes a really different set of questions. Well, you know this from Ghana, right? I mean, this is, you know, all the technology that gets hacked and created there.
Well, so the Ghanaian response to this, and maybe even more the Kenyan response to this, because right now Kenya is sort of the heart of where technology is getting hacked on the African continent, essentially says, look, we get it. We understand Intel's never going to understand Kenyans. So we're going to assume instead that all of this stuff can be disassembled and reassembled in the configuration that we need it. My new favorite product, this is being put together by friends of mine in a lab in Kenya. These are net geeks, which basically means that all they do is they go home and they sit on their laptops and they surf the web and they write code and sort of back and forth. And the problem with this is Nairobi, which means that the power goes off roughly every 3 hours. And at that point, you're screwed because your net goes down, you know, your wireless router goes down, your connection to the internet goes down. So what they've done is they built this wonderful little toy, they call it the brick. And the brick sits there, it's plugged into your wall, it recharges a battery. When the power goes off, it turns on, it starts bleeding off the battery, it uses a GSM modem to call up to the 4G phone network, and then it runs a little Wi-Fi network. So suddenly you basically have a mobile phone setting up a hotspot with a battery about this big, which is going to last as long as your laptop battery does. So for the 4 hours during which the power is off, you no longer have aircon, the fan doesn't work, it's dark, but you're on the web. And you know, and for my friends in Kenya, you know, this is pretty much the difference between Kenya being livable and Kenya not being livable. Is this a commercial product? No, not for Intel. You know, you probably shouldn't start building it. But they should.
Absolutely.
And so for me, you know, as wonderful as it is that, you know, Intel is bringing people like you in to, you know, have them show up and occasionally say, hey, Singaporeans, small houses. You know, my favorite story of yours on this is China, you know, one kid, you know, trying to design the family PC designed for 7 or 8 different children, you know, not necessarily appropriate for that market. But I think the flip side to this is these problems come into play because it's a very few countries that get to build technology now. And for me, one of the ways to really go about this is to sort of say, how do we democratize that process? And it may not be that we need to have a chip fab everywhere, although it's wonderful to see, you know, folks fooling around with 3D printing and so on and so forth here. But that sort of remix culture of essentially saying we can build technology that's appropriate to our local needs, we can build it out for what we need for our communities, and we're going to build technology so that it isn't a locked consumer product box that you have to pry apart with a proprietary tool to open it up, but it's designed to be taken apart and hacked and remixed. That's very much sort of where I'm hoping we're going to go with some of this.
And I think that's a nice place to end, because in some ways I think the promise of Sabernet was also about something that was flexible and hackable and rebuildable. I want to pause here and thank all of you for inviting both Ethan and I here, and I wanted to thank and acknowledge Ethan for a lovely talk.
And thank you as well, and thanks for having us.